Mr. Watson, Reel 3. And so we've got to the point where you joined the Tiresias of the Blue Funnel Line. Mm-hmm. Still in late 38, would it be?
Well, I was in Shanghai on the Tiresias when war was declared. So it must have been 38, 39. Be 39?
Yes, 39, right.
Beginning of 39, I think, but as near as I can remember.
How did you fit into the Tiresias? What were your jobs of all that?
Same as, you're a deckhand, you see.
But a boy seaman?
Deck boy, they called it. Deck boy, you can call it. Boy seaman was the other, I suppose, the official thing. But boy seaman, deck boy, same thing.
And how did you like it aboard the ship?
Oh, she was a different class altogether.
What was so much better about her?
Well, she looked better for a start. She had a nice blue funnel and white superstructure. She was much bigger. She carried a different cargo. It was mixed produce from Birmingham and the woolen mills and the linen factories of Lancashire and so on. It was crated, and she was going to a different part. She was going to the Far East. And she also, because of her, she carried two or three passengers going out to the plantations. They came on leave and went back with their families and so on. So she was a part, mainly cargo, but part, she took a number of deck passengers.
Now, what do you remember of this trip out to Shanghai?
Oh, it was quite normal and pleasant. No, the food was good. With a Chinese cook in the galley, and he cooked for the passengers, so therefore our food was much better than anything we got on the tram ship. You got ham and eggs every morning for breakfast, and one of my chores was to wash the dishes. And keep the mess. There was a little mess in the ship, and it also had showers right up in the bow of the ship for the crew. And you had, instead of the old hammocks, you had and wire bedsteads. You had proper bunks with fitted sheets, fitted pillowcase. A different class altogether. So that was the Tiresias. And we went to, the farthest we went to was Japan. I can still remember we went to Kobe, Osaka, that's two ports in Japan. We went to Port Swettenham on the way out to, in Malaya. And we also went to,
Tell me about Japan first, right? Because it was not far before the war. What was it like? Did you get ashore?
Oh, yes, got ashore. The Japanese, they were meticulous for medical exams. You had to give specimens of excreta, specimens of urine. They were, and they came on, I think they did it too. Show that they were superior somehow. They used to come aboard in white coats and so on, and you had to assemble there and they palavered around. Nothing. I think they just wanted to show that they were, you know, the boss, as it were. And we were merely coming there to supply their needs in industrial goods. And Kobe, Osaka.
What do you remember?
Nagasaki.
The outbreak of war. You were in Shanghai.
Yes.
Was that the way back?
On the way back.
What do you remember about that?
Well, there's a bit of story there. At that time, there was an international settlement in Shanghai. And the international settlement consisted of the embassies of Russia, Britain, all the other countries, on the Bund. That was the forefront of the harbour in Shanghai. All the big white buildings, colonial embassies and all that, right? and the bay, big bay, with the shipping in it. And the British part of the international settlement we could go into and went ashore, wandered through the town, and my uncle was in the Royal Royal Scots Fusiliers, who were a detachment there showing the flag. Now the Japanese were cutting up rough at that time, and behind the bund was a road, the main road, and rickshaws flying backwards and forwards, and I knew Jimmy was, my uncle, was in the army detachment there. So I had written to him previously and told them the date, I got that from the mate, when we would be there. So, having done that, I then went, there was a ferry going across. It consisted of a little motorboat with an old Ford engine, and it was an old lifeboat, ship's lifeboat, and the chap, Chinaman, took us back and forward, and he paid him whatever it was. And so I went ashore, and I got off, went up, and to look for him, to look for the place. And I'm going, got a rickshaw. I'm going down this the main road, and then another rickshaw coming up was my uncle. He had spotted the ship coming in, and was expecting me. And he had knew the ferry came across at that time, and there he was. Now, the Japanese at that time were very belligerent. And when he went down this time, they had occupied that part of Shanghai, and they had tanks in the streets facing the international settlement. But they hadn't stopped the traffic going down to these, you see. So I'm coming down in this rickshaw, meet him coming out, and we go into his barracks place. And there's a soldier in a kilt standing there with a cane, and directly opposite there's a Japanese tank with its gun pointing straight at him. You know, just across like where that shed is, there's a tank. And all that part is Japanese occupied, and this bit is an international settlement. And that was the day before war was declared. The Japanese had conquered the whole of that area of China, you see. So the Japanese were patrolling the river, and there was no movement allowed after dark. And 6 o'clock was the date, was the time they had, there was a curfew on the river. The Japanese controlled the whole of the river, but they hadn't stopped the international traffic on ships. But they had a curfew on the river because they didn't want infiltration from China into there. So, anyway, I met my uncle, and he said, right, we'll go to, what was her name, Ma. I'll probably remember it. This cafe was called Ma somebody or other, because she was a British subject running a little cafe there, and it was a favourite resort of the English speaking people. So we went up there, had a cup of tea and a chat, and by this time it was getting near 6 o'clock, and I said, look, I've got to get the ferry at 6 o'clock. And he says, oh, it doesn't matter. He says, we'll hire something. He says, I've got some money. However, I said, no, I want to get back to the ship and get because they'll be expecting me, wondering what's happened. So he turtles back to cover the ferry disappearing in the dusk. And there were other bunches there tied up. for hire. So he got a hold of one, and this was an old lifeboat with a car engine stuck in it, you see. And he did some, he had some money, and he sort of paid this bloke, and I got in. And this chap, when he got in, I noticed that his tiller was about 6 feet long, right up to the engine. I didn't think anything of it. It's a long, hell of a long tiller, you see, for this boat. I was having it out into the river. Of course, the Japanese patrolling the river. And, well, sitting there, I'd bought some silk, artificial silk shirts, white shirts, and I was very proud. This, you see, I was going back. And all of a sudden, I could see a little boat up further up the river, and little sparks were coming from it. And then I looked round, and the Chinaman driver is down in the bottom of the boat, and he's steering the blooming thing with his feet, you know, on his long tiller. And then I was hearing, and there was bullets landing in the water quite near me. And this was this Japanese boat trying to stop us across. So this bloke, he gets down in the bottom of the boat behind the engine, and by golly, I got down beside the engine as well. And he was steering by using his feet. He was down, sheltered by the engine. And I'm down alongside him. And these bullets were flying all over the place. And anyway, when we got back, you know, the jetties there had big piles and cross piles, you know, big solid beams. And this chap knew his business, because when we got over to the ship, and this thing is trying to get ahead of us, catch us, he shot through over the beam and in behind the ship. And all I did was, he'd go along these intertech beams and up through the ladders going up, you see. And up through the ladder and up into the ship. But he knew that he could get the water, he could get over that with it without damaging his boat. And of course they couldn't touch him, you see, under the jetty, and because he was behind the British ship, you see. So that was my encounter there. But I was pretty glad, up the ladder and onto the ship.
And that was the night of the 2nd.
Now, that was...
The night before the war broke out?
Yes, that night the war broke out. That's so it was, you can give the date there, 1939, wasn't it?
What did you think of the outbreak of war? I mean, how did you think it would affect you?
Well, I didn't imagine anything more than being on sailing on the ship at that time. I remember we left there. Oh, there was a scare. They thought the German battleship, what was the name of it now? One of the big, not the Tirpitz, was it?
Bismarck.
Bismarck was adrift, and the word was from the wireless operator, because we got all the guff from the whoop in the ship. Was that the Bismarck was adrift. They didn't know where it was. And it could be out in the east. So I remember that day, the white structure of the ship, there was a lot of white upper structure. We got buckets of grey paint from the ship chandler. I remember the mate going across and getting big drums of this grey paint from the ship chandler in Shanghai. And he came back with that paint, and we poured it into buckets and all the brushes that we could get, but that wasn't quick enough. We were actually using handfuls of waste, dipping them in the buckets and just wiping the whole ship over with, what a mess it made of the white, the decks and things. But that was in priority, get it painted grey. And there was a lot of white on it, you see. And so that night, of course, the word came through the wireless op. He was in constant listening out, you know. And you see, we carried a wireless operator on that ship, which is very useful. And war was declared that night. So the next day, we were plastering the thing with spray paint, and that night we set off empty for hell for leather, out back. We were empty by that time. We'd been to Japan and unloaded the stuff, and we came. The cargo holds of the ships. Oh no, we went to a place called Miki, Japanese port called Miki, M-I-C-K-I, I think it is. And there we had the holds. I think we got some oil fuel, because it was an oil ship. And the holds were tanks, actually. The holds had dry cargo going out, and some of them were also tanks, so that they had a huge lid, about the size of this, half the size of this room, which was held up against the wall going out and filled with dry goods, and coming back was used as a tank for liquid rubber, latex, and palm oil. So when we got out to Miki, they had specialized in coating the insides of these tanks with candle wax to prevent the rubber and so on and sticking, and also in putting the piping, the heating piping, which was stowed away, out of the way, connecting it all up so that hot water could be pumped through these tanks. And the purpose was, when we got to, on the way back to Malaya, we would fill the tanks with liquid rubber, and the water, the heat would keep it molten, you see. And so it could be pumped out. And also palm oil for making soap in these tanks. And these lids were down, and our job was to, the whole crew was to seal them by turning the bolts down on a rope insulation, so that the lid came down and then bring it down. But in Miki, they specialised in putting this piping in, coating the walls with wax. And they used to light a little fire in the bottom of the hold with bamboo and stuff, and melt this wax in buckets and paint it onto the sides of the tank.
So after you picked up the liquid rubber and palm oil from Malaya, where then?
Penang, we got the liquid rubber from there. And we were filled up, and what else? I don't think we took anything else. Oh yes, we took in some of the holes, tin pineapples, tin fruit. And it came in boxes. And us boys had to sit down in the hole to make sure that the coolies loading the stuff didn't split the cans and eat the fruit. Because, I mean, it was dry work and they were down in a hole, so you need somebody to watch them. So I used to sit down there, up there on a pile of boxes of cans, and take a knife with a spike on it, which we had, bore a hole in a little tin and a drink of juice. So there must have been a hell of a lot of cats arriving back in the UK with little holes in them and rotten fruit. But they're so thirsty, you know, in the heat.
Anything happened on the journey back?
Apart from submarine scares, we came back in a convoy and dodging about there, but we didn't, no one in the convoy was torpedoed, and we arrived safely back with tins of fruit. And
so what time will you get back? October? Would it still be September?
It must have been in October, yeah, by the time we got back. I remember we came into Gibraltar for some reason. I think it was to await the convoy to go around or something. I don't know why. But I know there was a scare there of submarines, not submarines, underwater attacks by rampant mines and nonsense like that. When we were on watch at night, we had to keep looking down to see that there was no bubbles coming up from people attacking the ship and that sort of thing.
And what happened when he got back?
Into Liverpool and bought Sunlight to unload all the soap, the liquid. So, but they sent us home on leave. I brought home I had a Japanese tea set, which Christine couldn't stand, so it was all packed in the box already, never opened. Well, open to look at, but never used. You could buy them very cheaply. These thin, you see them in the antique shows or something. And some bamboo artifacts, dowels, made of bamboo, and ornaments like that. Long since gone, God knows where. So that was that, and I went home on holiday, and then I wrote to the company and asked for another ship, and they said you would have to come down to Birkenhead because you would get short notice. And I went down to Birkenhead again in the Seaman's Mission, and I got they said, well, all we've got is a ship going round from Liverpool to Newcastle called the Diomede. So I went round dodging up the channel. Of course, the war was on by then. And then the Diomede.
And that was to Newcastle?
To Newcastle, yeah, yes. Liverpool to Newcastle.
What were you carrying there?
I think she was, I don't think we carried anything really. I think she was being positioned there to take a cargo, as far as I can remember. I can't remember us unloading anything. They had to position them, you see, where the cargo was coming from. So we went round and we went up the west, up the Dogger Bank and that, in a convoy. This convoy was going round the north of Scotland. We peeled off and the Tyne, and they went on round the north of Scotland. So that was that.
So what happened then? That was around about October still, would it be? Or into November?
I would think it would have been into November, but I can't remember really. After the Diomede, they said, well, we've got nothing else for you at the moment. So I went home, up to Voltaire near Forres. That's where we lived at that time.
To where was that?
Altar. A-L-T-Y-R-E. It's just near Forres. My parents had moved. And my father was then working at Kinross as an engineer, because he was trained as an engineer. He had to go to this estate work because he had chest problems. And was advised to get out of Glasgow and get up to the country. That's why he took the estate job. Get out in the fresh air. They didn't have the marvellous cures they have for things nowadays.
So what were you doing at home? Waiting?
No, I had... There was a lot of turbulence then about what Mum and Dad didn't do and all that. And I thought I would take a job. There was things of conscription, this thing's coming up. And I took a job with Logie Estate. That's an estate, Sir Alexander Grant's estate, further up there, about 9 miles from Forres, 8 miles from Forres.
So you were an estate worker?
So I took that job, and well, I sort of decided what to do. And then I volunteered for the RAF.
Now, why did you do that? I mean, you were a trained merchantman.
Merchantman, but you were trained in certain respects, but other respects it was a pretty unrewarding job.
So you'd had enough of it?
Yes.
And how did you...
I didn't have enough of the sea, but because I joined the Air Sea Rescue Service, you see.
Now, how exactly did you volunteer for the RAF, and when did you join up with them?
I joined up by saying I was 18 when I wasn't 18. I was 17 and a bit. I think the minimum age actually was, you could join at 17 and a half, but I know I was under the age limit, and I added a year to my age. And funnily enough, year I added to my age, saying I was born in 1921, I found in my records, they sent me some years ago a copy of my records, and they said, will you please write and amend any inaccuracies? After all those years, and it was all my postings in this paper, where I'd been, all this, right down to my squadron and to retirement, and it was before retirement, it was actually when I was in the recruiting business. And to check up if there were any mistakes, I altered my data. But all that years it was.
How did you go about volunteering? What was the medical like and things like that?
Oh, I just went through to Inverness.
That was where you joined up?
Funnily enough, I ended up, not ended up, but I finished one phase of my career as a recruiting officer in Inverness.
So when would you have joined? I mean, I'm still not sure of the date. 17 and a half would be halfway through April 1940?
It would have been, I suppose. I know that I was called forward for square bashing, and I was in the square bashing in August because it was bloody hot and it was near Liverpool.
So it was probably August that had there been a long gap between when you volunteered and when you were called up?
Yes, you were put on deferred service, what they call deferred service. In other words, you went through the attestation process, but your service was deferred until they decided to call you up, because there was such a crush at the initial stages that you had to go.